Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Tuesday, March 8th, 2005. We are hearing House Bill 5057, the Oregon Department of State Police. We are going to continue with the overview of the Operations Services Bureau of the Department of State Police. We have Major Dan Durbin present, commander of the Operations Services Bureau, and Major, before we get into your remarks, Mr. Wilson, our fiscal staff, has a document that he wants to talk about for a few minutes.
Madam Chair, hopefully not a few minutes, but the committee over a week ago asked for sort of an idea of what's out there on meth-related bills. This is a tracking document that actually comes from Judiciary Committee, so we're not both tracking, but this is a list of the bills that are in place today. And there are many more bills coming because the House side has, I think, a big stack of bills waiting to be introduced if they haven't already. So this will be out of date. It is already out of date probably from the floor session today. But it will give you an idea of what's out there. After about the third or fourth page in, or fifth, there's a document, a one page that looks like this, which sort of divides the subject area up in terms of and what bills affect those areas. And then the last page is a quick summary of what the governor's meth task force bills are, which are also included in part on that first list. Again, this is a working document. I've heard there are many more meth bills yet to be introduced on the House side, so this list will grow, and of course many of them are doubled. And the shading are, since it's a judiciary document, those are the bills that are not in judiciary right now are the ones that are shaded.
They haven't gotten there?
They have been referred to a separate committee, Madam Chair, Representative Hannah. So those that are not in judiciary.
Well, just as a sidebar, members, clearly there is a need for coordination around the methamphetamine policy area, and your chair will be meeting with the judiciary chairs and any other chairs and leadership around a coordinated strategy for dealing with the bills that have been introduced thus far. So please stay tuned, and we'll continue to compile information and make sure that it gets shared with the committee. We are opening without a quorum. Senator Devlin is ill. We wish him a speedy recovery. Senator Winters will be away for a while, and we also wish her a speedy recovery. And so we are opening without a quorum. Again, welcome, Major Durbin, and please tell us what you expect to cover with us this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My intentions are to initially deal with the question that you posed yesterday about the law enforcement data system, and then to move on to the conclusion of the testimony regarding the Patrol Services Division. Then I will be complete for the Operations Bureau testimony.
The superintendent is not here this afternoon.
He will be coming, Madam Chair, is my understanding, and we'll have some comments after the major's on the question regarding the patrol division and relationship with local governments.
We'll look forward to that. I know that he wanted to speak yesterday. We just didn't get to that.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, in response to the question that was posed yesterday, do the actions of the legislature during the 2002 special sessions, along with the subsequent failure of ballot measure 28 and the budget rebalance by the governor for December 2002 and the economic forecast reduction, the law enforcement data system, specifically the Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Unit, was eliminated at the end of February 2003. This was after the failure of ballot measure 28. The law enforcement data system took other cuts as well, but those will be reported on during the testimony by the Support Services Bureau Commander, Major Spirit. Now, the unit at that time had three employees, and the positions remained vacant for about 18 months until grant dollars with a match from the Oregon Health Science University was acquired. The Oregon Uniform Crime Reporting Unit remains with about an 18-month backlog of data. The 2003 annual report has not been completed, and the data is not available, as I reported yesterday, regarding the performance measure relating to the number of arrests versus the total reported crimes on rural and interstate highways and state property.
Is there, Major, a document, or perhaps you can just shed more light on the impact of this crime unit not being fully, this crime reporting unit not being fully functional? What is the impact of not having, or not being able to get to the backlog, not having data available? Again, if you could help us understand, what is the impact of the cut that has been experienced?
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, if I can divert some of that to Major Spirit's testimony, I know he's going to address that, but just briefly, this has a much broader impact to all law enforcement and, you know, government agencies in the state. Initially, it's data that we use, that we analyze to evaluate our programs and our successes and our failures and our statistical information. Some of it is gathered through that system.
We'll look forward to Major Spirit then completing that picture for us. Please continue, and would you direct us to what page you are on, if there is a page?
Yes, I can't give you the exact page because my testimony doesn't match up entirely with yours, but we're going to start off just after the commercial vehicle information. And in reference to the occupant protection.
I think we're on page 8, Madam Chair, data 52, maybe the third paragraph down.
Yes, thank you.
The division has a number of troopers that are specially trained in the area of occupant protection. They work very closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation to help educate the public about seat belts and child restraints. Now, our troopers assist at seatbelt safety clinics, and they enforce the occupant protection laws in an effort to gain, again, voluntary compliance, which, according to the Oregon Department of Transportation, is at approximately 92.6% statewide. This is one of the highest rates in the nation and a very successful program. Oregon is one of the best in the nation also in the area of highway work zone safety. Division members work very closely, again, with the Oregon Department of Transportation to provide an enforcement presence to reduce injuries and deaths in these areas. Now, there has been a significant increase in these work zones across the state, and so we are pleased to announce that during 2003, troopers provided over 8,800 hours of work zone safety and issued more than 1,000 citations within these designated work zones. But the most significant factor here is that in 2003, the Department of Transportation reported that there were two work zone fatalities, and neither of those deaths were work zone workers. The division utilizes three specialized support programs to assist in addressing transportation safety needs in problem areas throughout the state.
I believe that Representative Hanna has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You got ahead of me before I got to the question on the occupant protection. How much training is done for troopers in terms of the occupant protection work that they do? And does that training, does it or will it take place at the new training center?
This is, some of the training is dealt with at the basic level. And then there is ongoing training at each one of the work sites because we have individuals that are in special positions that go to seminars on an annual basis and receive updated training and information and take it back to their work sites to give in-service training to their work sites, to employees. So it would be yes and no, Madam Chair and Representative Hanna.
Follow up. And could you give us an idea in terms of the safety clinics? A, do we have troopers that's their only task or that's their main task, or is this a diversity of troopers? And could you tell us about the amount of time at those type of clinics?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I can't give you that exact information right now, but I can tell you that we have troopers across the state that participate sometimes in clinics that are hosted solely by the department and at other times with other law enforcement agencies to address training and evaluation, taking a look at child protective systems and things such as that. Would you like to add anything?
If I may, for the record again, Lieutenant Gary Miller, Assistant Director of the Patrol Services Division. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, just to provide a little bit more detail, initial training for occupant protection enforcement, education enforcement, it's roughly just 2 hours, and it's done at the local level, it's very minimal. For the clinics, it's 40 hours, and it's generally done through a contracted person with the Oregon Department of Transportation, generally not through DPSST or through a new academy, but it would be done on a contractual basis throughout the area. Through, I believe right now it's the Alliance of Community Traffic Safety in Oregon is doing most of the educating on that and training. We have roughly 5 to 10 troopers around the state that do some of that educational work on a limited basis.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
The division utilizes these specialized support programs to assist in addressing transportation safety needs in problem areas throughout the state. Now, that includes the division's motorcycle program. Currently, we have 7 motorcycles, 2 in Salem and 4 in Portland. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
4 in Portland. They provide a specialized service in the support and enhancement of crash reduction and other transportation safety services. The division's aircraft enforcement program provides a specialized assistance for the enforcement of speed and aggressive driving on the state and interstate highways. The division has also implemented a new specialized support program known as the Aggressive Driver Enforcement Program. The program was in a trial phase from July through December of 2004, and then was fully implemented as a support program in January of this year. Now, this program is designed to target the well-documented aggressive driver. Now, as an agency, we define aggressive driving as the simultaneous commission of 2 or more hazardous moving violations that are likely to endanger persons or property, or any single intentional moving violation that requires a defensive action by another driver, or committing a traffic violation in an effort to intimidate motorists. Now, from July through December, this unit completed over 400 traffic stops, and subsequent enforcement action has occurred on those dangerous drivers. During a typical month in just the Salem area alone, more than 500 driving complaints are received by our dispatch centers. I'm thinking of one recent incident that occurred where our aggressive enforcement unit stopped a motorcycle going 135 miles an hour and had another one on I-5 in the Salem area that was able to elude at 155 miles an hour. Now, currently, 4 officers are assigned to this unit, 1 in each Portland, Salem, Springfield, and Central Point. The non-traditional police vehicles are equipped with forward and rear video cameras and cell phones to respond to and properly document these incidents. Now, the last 2 division priority enforcement programs assist us in reducing crime on rural, state, and interstate highways. Crime reduction, which is linked to benchmark 61, or the overall reported crimes per 1,000 Oregonians, as well as benchmark 62, which is linked to juvenile crime, is accomplished through 2 things. 1, criminal apprehension through patrol enforcement, and 2, juvenile crime education enforcement. Now, these 2 programs attempt to reduce crime through traffic contacts and patrol enforcement. And this is accomplished by these things: responding to and investigating crimes, making arrests based on warrants and probable cause, clearing highways of abandoned vehicles, and assisting motorists in needs. Now, ultimately, this is accomplished through what we refer to as high-visibility traffic patrol, which decreases public harm and reduces crime on the state and interstate highways. Speaking about criminal apprehension through patrol enforcement, the data for 2003 and 2004 indicates that our troopers were very successful with that program. As a direct result of a traffic stop, division members made almost 17,000 criminal arrests, served over 6,000 arrest warrants, made over 4,700 drug arrests that resulted in the seizure of more than 438 pounds of marijuana, 82 pounds of cocaine, 41 pounds of methamphetamine, 8.5 pounds of heroin, numerous mobile methamphetamine labs. They recovered more than 611 stolen vehicles worth an estimated $4.8 million, and they investigated more than 315 stolen property incidents that resulted in the recovery of an estimated $1.1 million in property. Now, the department has recently acquired two narcotics canines to help support this program. These dogs are currently situated with a patrol trooper, one in Pendleton and the other in Central Point. Second area, juvenile crime education and enforcement, is an area of concern for all law enforcement, including the patrol division. Now, in 2003 and 2004, division members issued more than 7,000 traffic citations to juveniles, and they charged more than 1,000 juveniles with criminal offenses, including drugs, alcohol, and stolen vehicles. In conclusion, most state troopers live to help people in legitimate need, even when it means jeopardizing their own life. I began my career with this deeply embedded in my mind. In fact, in 1980, while attending the basic recruit school at Camp Riley in Astoria, Oregon State Police Sergeant James Shepard was gunned down and murdered. Many troopers acting in the line of duty have given this ultimate sacrifice. Others have been physically injured, and even more have been scarred from what they have encountered over the course of their careers. I personally will never forget standing on the front porch in the early morning hours delivering a message to a wife and mother of several children that her husband would never return home again. Most likely, as I speak here today, another state trooper is having to deliver a similar message. There are also motorists who are being terrorized by aggressive and road rage drivers. There are children who are sexually and physically abused. Thousands of people have lost their lives and hundreds of thousands have been injured from alcohol and drug-impaired drivers. There was no greater priority at their time of need. As the Operations Bureau Commander for the Oregon State Police, I thank you for considering these things as you establish the priority of the programs and services that are provided by the Department to fulfill our mission to develop, promote, and maintain protection of people, property, and the natural resources of this state. This concludes my testimony for the Operations Services Bureau. Thank you.
Further questions or comments for the Major? Representative Hannah.
I actually have a follow-up question to yesterday. We, as you recall, we had a discussion about the commercial vehicle inspections done by state police. And someone later brought to light that potentially those stops were for probable cause. In other words, you don't just stop somebody to inspect the vehicle. I wonder if there's any correlation, or can we back that up from the standpoint that are there citations on all 18,000 of those? Are there citations that correspond to those stops? Or would we look at some percentage of those stops that ended up being a violation for the actual truck inspection?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I just happen to have some information here in front of me regarding 2003 that may help address that question. During 2003, division members issued 6,198 truck speeding citations. They issued 3,289 other citations, not including truck speeding. They issued 1,152 logbook violations. They seized 146 radar detectors. They put 1,389 drivers out of service because of violations. They put 577 vehicles out of service, which placed the total out-of-service drivers and vehicles of the trucks that they contacted as a result of inspections and violations at about 15%.
I appreciate that. I'd like to follow up because I want to understand this better.
Certainly.
If we did 15,692 commercial vehicle inspections, is it fair to say we did that many inspections, but we pulled over 6,198 people for probable cause, and the rest were just to do the vehicle inspection?
No, Madam Chair and Representative Hanna. The vast majority of the contacts that are made with commercial vehicle enforcement is as a result of a violation that was committed. A very small percentage of the contacts were done at what we call trucker checks, and these were coordinated activities that took place at maybe a way station where there was a coordination with motor carrier enforcement and other agencies, and they were specifically looking for other things regarding mechanicals such as driver impairment, registration. Would you like to address that?
Yes, if I may, please. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, the Oregon Department of Transportation determined several years ago that the majority of the crashes in the state of Oregon were from driver behavior problems, speeding, lane changes, falling too close, those type of things. It used to be that they inspected things on a level one basis or crawling under the truck like we were talking about yesterday. But our direction has found that most of the crashes, most of fatalities in Oregon occur because of driver behavior problems or where they commit those offenses that we just talked about. Very few of them are the mechanical issues. That's why we do not address those, or if we do, it's on a very limited basis. And our inspections are known as level two or level three walk-around inspections that are designed for the police officer or the state trooper out on the highway to ensure the safety on our roadways.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that, and I still don't have the number in my mind. We still did nearly 16,000 commercial vehicle inspections. We're still only talking about less than 6,200 citations. How do you bridge the gap?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I think one thing that's not being considered here is I'm telling you that there was almost 10,000 citations that were issued, but it's also very important to realize that there were thousands upon thousands of warnings, because the contact does not always result in a citation. Sometimes it results in a warning. When I was the station commander at Central Point, for example, I kept data, and the Department of Transportation also keeps data and can give exact numbers based upon the inspections and the numbers of citations, as well as the types of citations and the warnings that were given and the activities that took place, as, for example, the numbers of vehicles that were placed out of service and the numbers of drivers that were placed out of service. So we can give you more detailed information regarding that question.
Follow. Please continue.
Well, I appreciate it. And you see where I'm going. I mean, I'm simply trying to put it together. And I appreciate hearing, too, that you pull somebody over, they did something wrong, the officer in his judgment says, hey, pay attention or whatever, and then completes a truck inspection. That's a potential. That could happen, right?
Madam Chair,
as you speak in terms of a warning.
Sure.
Yeah. So that gets the number closer. And I appreciate that.
Would you also share with us a profile? What is the profile of an aggressive driver?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the most typical profile is high speed and another dangerous action, such as following too close or unsafe or illegal lane changes. Majority of the motorists that I've encountered can fully describe what that's like. It's those drivers that make them get white-knuckled because of the danger that they feel from the behavior of another driver.
Okay. what you have described as a part of the profile is the behavior. Are these predominantly male drivers, or is that just my assumption?
Well, Madam Chair, I don't know that I can answer that question right now, but I can tell you that some of our information has showed that the majority of these activities are taking place during commuter hours. And as a station commander, again, when I was in Central Point, I found out that our highest speeds that we dealt with on the Interstate 5 was during lunchtime, when people were racing around trying to make appointments. Tim Miller?
If I may, Madam Chair. I've been out riding with the aggressive driving people and those officers, and had a chance to discuss that particular question with him, the Salem officer, and he described it. Any ages, any gender, there was really no one specific common denominator to an aggressive driver.
Thank you. Very helpful. Representative Hannah.
It just brings up a question. Typically on a stop for an aggressive driver, would the citation be a elevated reckless driving, or a, I don't know what you'd call them all, but some elevated level of citation?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah. They could be elevated charges depending on the seriousness of the offense, or they could be individual specific violations such as speeding and or following too close or lane change, as the major described. Or if it's a very, if it qualifies as a reckless driving offense, then our protocol requires the person is taken into custody. It can be any of those situations.
Again, Major, thank you very much for your presentation. I also want to thank you for your service to the state of Oregon. Are you going to remain for the next presentation?
Enough.
Well, then I also want to thank you, and also thank you for your service as well. Next panel, well,
thank you.
Superintendent, would you like to come up?
Yes.
Okay. And we might as well have Major Peter Spirup come up with you, because we'll be moving into the overview of the Support Services Bureau after we hear from the superintendent.
We're not going to go through that again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Ronald C. Ricker, Superintendent of the State Police. My purpose here today is to respond to you and the committee on the question of transferring some or all of the patrol functions of the state police to counties. I will respond in two ways. First, as to the public policy issues associated with the question, and second, as to some of the practical issues associated with implementing such a policy decision. There is little doubt that the state, there is little that the state does that could not be transferred to local governments as a matter of public policy. For example, there's nothing to preclude the state from transferring the crime labs, Fish and Wildlife Enforcement, thank you, the medical examiner, or for that matter, many of the functions of other state agencies like the Department of Corrections or Human Services to local government. So thus the question is not could it be done, but one must consider the impacts of making such a choice. The state of Hawaii is the only state in the nation that does not have a state police or highway patrol function at the state level. The rest of the nation recognizes that traffic safety on the state and interstate highway system is a state responsibility. The Oregon State Police Patrol Division, like its counterparts in other states, works closely with state and federal transportation authorities in developing and implementing its traffic safety and enforcement programs. You just heard about many of these programs during Major Durbin's testimony. Having these programs developed and implemented on a statewide level provides for continuity and consistency. Still, the very real and unfortunate truth is that by the end of the coming biennium, there will have been as many people killed in Oregon traffic crashes since September 11th as were killed in the terrorist attacks of that same day, September 11, 2001. And to our frustration, almost no one is talking about it. In addition, it is important that the committee understand that our patrol division does many more things than write traffic citations. Major Durbin just quoted some numbers that are different than what I was quoting. He's quoting 2004, and I was going to quote 2003. More than 12,000 criminal charges as a result of activities of our patrol division members, and that was during the year of the layoffs. I think Major Durbin just quoted 17,000 in calendar 2004. In 2003, there were 2,364
drug charges, 2,978 misdemeanor and felony warrants, 123 charges for carrying concealed firearms or knives, recovery of 172 stolen vehicles, and 145 charges of resisting arrest or interfering with a police officer. And in one case, there was a seizure of 2 pounds of crystal meth, $7,000 cash, and a stolen firearm, which was the largest seizure of crystal methamphetamine in Yamhill County, and all of that was the result of a traffic stop for speeding on a state highway. There are 329 authorized personnel in the patrol division of the OSP. Most people agree this is less than half of what we need. They are supported by a considerable amount of infrastructure outside the funding lines of the patrol division. The agency's command structure, support services, technological and communication systems enable the patrol division to accomplish its many missions throughout the state. One of the primary benefits of having a statewide uniform law enforcement capacity is to support local communities in times of need. The state police can and does send troopers in response to civil disturbances, major criminal investigations, emergencies, and disasters. Troopers from anywhere in Oregon can be sent to any other place in Oregon to assist with a tactical operation. They arrive trained and equipped to work with each other and with local governments. This is one of the basic safety net services the State Police Patrol Division provides. And you might be surprised how often these services are requested even by the largest jurisdictions in the state. The City of Portland, for example, routinely calls upon us for the assistance of our mobile response team to help with demonstrators in downtown Portland. We always go, and at no cost to the requesting agency, regardless of their size. As for traffic enforcement, it is true that any police officer can write traffic tickets. We believe, however, that traffic enforcement must always be about traffic safety. There are local governments in Oregon who have and are openly regarding traffic enforcement as a source of revenue. Some are talking publicly, even locally, about citing motorists into certain courts to achieve a higher fine. At a time when the legislature is very appropriately trying to eliminate the Coburg situation, one must be realistic about the probability of creating many more such situations in local governments across the state. Shame on us if the day ever comes that Oregonians accurately perceive that traffic citations are being written to generate revenue for law enforcement. If this happens, police-community relations will plummet in jurisdictions across the state. Finally, on the public policy aspect of the question, it is my assumption that transferring the patrol division responsibilities to local governments would mean the elimination of the 329 currently funded positions in the OSP. If this is true, the committee needs to understand that the state troopers are assigned to in three of our divisions. If one were to eliminate the 329 in patrol, it would not be those 329 individuals who would leave. It would be the most junior 329 in the agency. Thus, the criminal and fish and wildlife divisions would be dramatically affected as well. The result would be that criminal and fish and wildlife would be staffed by the remaining officers, whether or not their training or interests aligned with the work they were assigned. We saw some of this in the layoffs of 2003, and it was highly problematic for the agency, for the officers, the legislature, our partners, and certain interest groups. To choose to repeat this type of chaos would be most unfortunate. Finally, it would dramatically curtail, if not end, our ability to field mobile response and SWAT team, the mobile response and SWAT teams we now have, because many of these officers have regular patrol assignments, and they would be lost in the process. Finally, I want to point out a number of challenges that would have to be overcome if, in fact, this transfer of responsibility occurred. First, as I mentioned previously, there would be no ability to deploy officers complete with communications equipment across the state. While many local governments can talk to each other, and I mean in the radio communication sense, most emergency communication systems cannot. The counties have more than 50 911 centers. The OSP has two dispatch centers handling statewide communications for the state police and with partnerships with ODOT, Department of Corrections, and others. This capability enables our people to be sent anywhere in the state without communications interruptions or makeshift arrangements. In a tactical operation, communications is the most critical element of an emergency response. Local governments just don't have that capability outside their own jurisdiction, and to buy it would be cost prohibitive. A transfer of our responsibilities to local government could not happen without substantial planning. They certainly don't have the staff on hand now. They would have to hire and train a great number of officers, and this would require coordination with DPSST, its academy, etc., and would in some cases even be more costly than having troopers do the work. At least four counties now pay higher salaries, as do many cities in the state, than does the state police, and a couple of more counties are about on par. The chair's question also mentioned geography. Some of our local government counterparts believe the state police are needed more in rural areas than in the Portland metropolitan area and the Willamette Valley. We certainly understand the argument. In fact, the OSP used to have more than 150 troopers assigned to three 24-hour offices in the Portland metro area. Today, we have fewer than 50 located in one office and a substation. None of them work 20. There's no 24-hour coverage anywhere in the state. And in our last recruit class, none of the recruits were assigned anywhere along the Interstate 5 corridor. On a given day, it is true that these urban centers have more police officers available to them than in rural Oregon. The metro area's agencies have been affected by budget cuts to the OSP. We should be patrolling all the interstate highways in Oregon. The lack of resources already caused our substantial staff reductions in the metro area. The fact is, however, that every Oregonian is served by the state police in some way. And many local governments, including the largest ones in the state, call upon us for help when circumstances warrant. In a system of public safety, everyone is at risk to have a situation exceed their capacity. This is true even on a national level. So you call to the next level for reinforcements. That's what the legislature envisioned when it created the state police in 1931. That is the model of 49 of the United States. And if we were the Hawaiian Islands, where the counties are actually separate islands, perhaps this would make sense. Madam Chair, we are a state trying to deal with a resource issue, not a roles and responsibilities issue. Thus, the solution is one of resources, not abdicating our responsibilities. I would be happy to answer any questions that you or the other members of the committee may have.
Superintendent, please make that report available to the committee, if you would. Thank you.
We have it for you.
And just to start the questioning, your testimony is that there's currently no 24-hour coverage anywhere in the state.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
By the state police, understanding that. When did the 24-hour coverage cease?
I'll have to get you an exact date, but my recollection is that when we, in the 03-05 biennium, or following the end of the 01-03 biennium, when we set out to execute the budget that we were given by the legislature in the current biennium, was probably when the last of the 24-hour offices, meaning Portland, Springfield, the Medford area, those were the last ones to stop, and I would say as the beginning of the current biennium.
All right. Questions or comments for the superintendent? Appreciate the thoroughness of your response, and we will make sure that the co-chairs receive copies of the testimony. In fact, you're responding to questions that they raised.
Yes.
I believe we're ready to move on, unless you have further comments.
The only comment, Madam Chair, is we appreciate the opportunity to respond to the question, and if there are any subsequent follow-up questions on this in this area by the committee or the co-chairs, we'd be more than happy to respond at any time.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and we're pleased that you're feeling better.
Thank you.
Major Peter Spira. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Major Peter Spirup. I'm the commander of the Support Services Bureau. I've invited Dave Schmierbaugh up here with me today. He's the Division Director for Forensic Services Division. I'll begin my discussion this afternoon by talking about Forensics Division after a few brief opening comments.
And could you direct us to the pages?
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, it's page 27 of 28 is where I'll begin.
Thank you. Please continue.
I'd like to thank the committee in advance for this opportunity to share this information. What I'll be doing here is providing an overview of the Support Services Division, the Support Services Bureau. The Bureau consists of five divisions, And as you heard from Major Durbin, the state police is made up of two separate bureaus. This one, the five divisions include the Forensic Services Division, Information Management Division, Human Resource Services Division, the Gaming Enforcement Division, and the State Medical Examiners Division. These five divisions provide a broad spectrum of support services to the Oregon State Police and to the broader criminal justice community here in Oregon. They're critical services. I'll begin my overview today by talking about the Forensic Services Division. The purpose of the Forensic Services Division is to provide scientific, technical, and investigative support to the regarding forensics analysis. And our goal is, since we are a sole source function, our crime labs are the only state crime labs in the state, or the only crime labs in the state. Our goals are to provide timely and accurate state-of-the-art services that will ultimately solve crime and benefit the entire criminal justice system. As you can see in the outline, the division operates under various statutory authority. These are primarily broken down by the different specialties that are covered with the Forensic Services Division. As I mentioned earlier, our Forensic Services Division is the only full services forensic laboratory system in the state. The legislature created this function with the state police in 1939, and we provide this unique service for the entire state. 89% of the function provided by the Forensic Services Division is provided for agencies outside the Oregon State Police. For example, 65% of the services are for city police departments, 19% are for sheriff's departments, and then there's 5% for other agencies. And those would include such agencies as federal government agencies, tribal nations, or fire departments. Our forensics laboratory system is made up of two major components. The first part of that would be our forensics laboratories, and these are strategically located throughout the state of Oregon. We have a lab in Bend, Central Point, Ontario, Pendleton, Portland, and Springfield. We have both large and small laboratories. For your information, the lab in Portland has recently been moved to the Clackamas area. We have a brand new state-of-the-art forensics laboratory that also houses the State Medical Examiners Division. It's located out near Costco in Clackamas. That's our largest forensics laboratory and is the state's only DNA laboratory. For your information, the Forensic Services Division currently is staffed with 107 full-time employees. 14 of these are managers, and these employees are strategically assigned around the state, and most of them work specific disciplines. As you can see in the outline, the disciplines are listed. As we go down through that list, we have arson, clandestine laboratories, controlled substances, DNA, firearms and tool mark comparison, latent print, primary examinations, which are the initial examinations on evidence when they are brought to the crime lab, question document, serology, which has to do with blood work, toxicology, trace evidence, crime scene investigation. We also provide courtroom testimony based on the forensics analysis, and provide forensics training to local officers around the state. The Forensics Laboratory also operates the Anonymous Analysis Program, which has to do with parents or guardians turning in suspected substances that are analyzed. The second major component beyond the crime laboratories is our implied consent program. And this has to do with breath testing related to drunk drivers. Our implied consent unit is located in Portland. These personnel are responsible for supporting and maintaining 169 intoxilizers located around the state. They are located in, for example, in jails, sheriff's departments, police departments, and they support all of the drunk driving arrests that are made statewide. There are approximately 20,000 drunk drivers arrested, and this intoxilizer system supports those arrests.
The division's customers include all police officers and sheriff's departments in the state, as well as the Oregon State Police and more than 400 fire departments. We also obviously support the 36 district attorneys located around the state. Next, I would like to speak about our performance measures. The division has two primary performance measures. One of them deals with customer satisfaction, and the second one has to do with turnaround time, and that's the turnaround time of evidence.
Representative Hanna has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you got past the lab information, it was noted in some of our information that the backlog of lab work, and I'm assuming this means even at the new lab, had gone from 23 days to somewhere up over 40 days. Do you have an update on that situation?
Madam Chair,
we're in a new lab, I thought it would get better.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I'm going to specifically discuss that when we get to the benchmark related to turnaround time. And it's true that they have increased to nearly 46 days. The first benchmark, though, deals with customer satisfaction. And this is linked to overall reported crimes per 1,000 Oregonians as far as state benchmarks. The customer satisfaction is measured through surveys that are done on postcards. We have four different postcards that are used that measure different aspects of our operation, forensics division. One card deals with forensics laboratory. The other is the intoxilizer program. We have one related to crime scene investigation and courtroom testimony. These cards are provided to our partners and our customers and are returned, and then the results are tabulated. Each of these services are scored on a scale of 1 to 4, and those results are compiled. As of, for the first 6 months of 2004, our rating was a 3.7 out of 4 possible points. We are obviously pleased with that number. It's fairly high. Although I think it's important to point out that both anecdotally, as you can hear from the division director, his phone rings off the hook about turnaround time. We get rated fairly low on the turnaround of evidence. That's also the receives the lowest rating on the postcard surveys.
A question for you. Need some additional information around the performance measure. How many customers are there, and then how many surveys were sent to those customers, how many returned, so that we have some idea of what the overall scores and rankings mean.
Okay, Madam Chair, we can get that information. I'll be glad to let Dave respond to that. This is an ongoing process. It doesn't stop, is one point I would like to make. The information I provided for the first 6 months of 2004 was just a snapshot. So we do have an ongoing process. These cards are handed out routinely.
Handed out or mailed?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is David Schmerbach. I'm your Forensic Services Division Director.
Could you spell your last name, please?
Yes. It's S-C-H-M-I-E-R, B as in boy, A-C-H.
Thank you.
We routinely send out, with every report, 10% of the reports get a card that are mailed out to the officer who submitted the evidence for the card that has to do with the examinations. On the courtroom testimony, we encourage our people to take these cards and hand them to both the prosecutor and the defense attorney at every trial that we attend. Now, that's not always done because people forget the cards. Same is true on the implied consent ones. They have a formula of about 10% to get these cards on a random basis. I don't have information on the number of those that are sent out versus returned, but I'll be happy to get that for you.
That's going to be a very important piece of information. The performance measure would have more meaning and would frankly be more acceptable if we understood the data behind the measure. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Take one step back, please. Could you please explain to me the implied consent and breath test of how that operates? You have six FTEs that are providing that capability, but I mean, are they the initial test down the road, or do you don't bring the people back into one location? So I don't understand how we're doing those, or is this training and what those six people are doing, and where your big expense is there for $2.7 billion, 2.8.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the breath tests are not done on the road. They are done at centralized locations. We have those machines strategically located around the state, like I said earlier, at jails and police departments and other locations. So the officer will bring the person to that facility, and the breath test is given at that time.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, in addition to a supervisor for the unit, we have two repair techs, and those two people are working full-time and then some overtime trying to keep this aging fleet of intoxilizers working. We also have two scientists that are constantly performing the scientific testing to make sure those instruments are truly reading accurately. And the remaining staff are support staff that performs all of the requests for the documentations for court. Follow up?
Certainly.
Thank you. That's very good. That clarifies that. And none of this money has replaced those units. This is operational costs. There's no, you're not filling in, replacing any of those units in this amount, I'm assuming.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnick, as you'll hear in phase two, there is a process in place this biennium to replace this aging fleet through a certificate of purchase.
Not part of this money.
No, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett mentioned $2.7 or $2.8 million. In these figures, a little less than 1.6 of that, the other funds, represents this one-time purchase of replacing all these, and this will be done through COP. And this represents the money spent to replace them. So that is being proposed in the governor's budget. And then you'll find debt service elsewhere in the budget for that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd recommend that be highlighted for the co-chairs, because that seemed like an expense, a big expense, because I don't think we had that anywhere yet. We're going to, or maybe going to get it later. But
Is this the only capital? I think this may be the only sort of capital, special capital purchase in the state police that COPs are being used for.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple things. One, these machines have to be like certified every 6 months or on a very regular tested and certified in order to be valid. Valid information brought into court, or you could get a ticket thrown out, can't you, if the machines haven't been certified?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's correct. They are routinely certified, and that is a reason that a citation would be dismissed or an arrest would be dismissed if the machine isn't properly kept up.
So if we didn't have this program, in effect, it would be very, very difficult to get any drunk driver conviction.
Certainly this, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, this is a really important piece of equipment that allows us to convict drunk drivers. It's an important piece of evidence.
Now, if we would replace the machines, would there be any savings? Would the new machines need to be certified, or would there be any savings in terms of easier to test them, or... Hopefully that you wouldn't have to repair them as often, but are they easier to maintain?
Chair Gorley, Representative Hansen, I'll let Dave answer that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is certainly our hope. As with any new system, we would hope that would be true. We're hoping to see a significant reduction in the repair, but the remaining components I discussed and the FTEs that are associated with them would not change. And remember, every time you make a change this large, you know, or you're changing an instrument, you have to validate the instrument, you have to retrain the entire staff of law enforcement to use the instrument, and then you have to physically deploy. So I'm not sure we'll see any savings in this biennium, but soon thereafter we hope to see a savings.
The other question is on the customer satisfaction survey. There's no information from 01 to 05. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that's just a steady number over that time period. That straight line represents that the numbers basically sits at that level.
Okay.
I also just point out briefly back to the intoxilizer issue. There is the COP for the purchase of the new equipment, but what's not reflected in the budget is any funds to train all the agencies around the state. That's something we're going to need to work out, and don't currently have in the budget any funding for that part of a new program.
Madam Chair. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would that be the same type of equipment that sheriff's departments? I mean, is there a standard statewide?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, there is a standard. The state police are charged with running the statewide intoxilizer program, so we have standardized equipment around the state for all agencies to use. The sheriff's departments don't have different equipment. They use our equipment. The Marine Board does have some handheld units, but law enforcement around the state uses our equipment.
Please continue.
If I would just refer you next to on page 30 to the graph that is there, it does demonstrate the level of response that we've received. Again, the 4-point is the potential, and the you can see the score since 1994 have remained fairly high. We continue to get a lot of support from the criminal justice system for our forensics division. They appreciate the work. Again, the exception to that is there is some concern and frustration with the turnaround time within the labs.
Are you going to have difficulty compiling the information that we're seeking, the information, the data behind this particular performance measure? How many customers? How many surveys actually distributed, how many surveys returned, so that, again, we have a clearer picture of what this graph is telling us.
Madam Chair, if I understand your question, are you concerned about us responding to your question?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I think we can get that information without too much trouble. If we do have a lot of trouble, I'll get back to you, but I think I could have that for you in the next 24 hours.
All right, that's great. Thank you.
Our second performance measure in forensics division is turnaround time, and this is accomplished through a monthly measurement of all our program areas, and it identifies the elapsed time between the time we get the request or the evidence is submitted and we're able to answer or provide the customer with the information that they need. Currently, just to set some context for this performance measure, we are currently turning away 33%, or approximately 33% of what we previously received as a workload in the forensics division. And this is accomplished through a triage process. We simply have more work out there than we're able to accomplish. So we've developed with our partners, the district attorneys, and the labs all working together a triage a process and establish some guidelines for submitting evidence to our forensics laboratory. Even with that in place, our turnaround times currently are averaging 46 days and continue to be our number one complaint from our customers. The goal for our performance measure here is 15 days, and that's based on customer surveys. Obviously, we're not meeting that goal. You can see by looking at the chart below, which I'll go over in more detail in just a moment, that since 1998 we've ranged from about the low 20 days to our current high of nearly 46 days. The graph on page 31 has actually quite a bit of information on it. It begins in July of 1998 through January of 2005. And if you'll look to the extreme left, you'll notice there's three different lines charted. The top one has to deal with what we call the overall elapsed time. The middle one, which is near the 20, is the analytical portion of our analysis. And then the line at the bottom near the 10 is the non-analytical. And let me just define those for you. The analytical is the actual scientific analysis of the evidence. The non-analytical has to do with the clerical support that goes into preparing responses that deal with that evidence and the scientific analysis. And then the top line is the overall combination of both of those processes. And as I mentioned earlier, you can see that the currently the overall combination of time is near 46 days.
Representative Hansen, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Is this work triaged? I mean, if you're dealing with trying to get information to solve a murder or something like that, is that moved ahead of maybe an analyzation of a marijuana case or...
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I think that's the idea behind the system. I mean, the less important things, you can break them into person crimes and property crimes and some general categories like that. It's more complex than that, and we actually have some documents that we could refer to you that lay out this triage process or our guidelines. But generally, a person crime is a higher priority than a property crime. And it's that kind of a process. And then, of course, there's always exceptions. You never say never to anything, but in a general way, I hope that answers your question.
It would be very helpful to see the guidelines and to have a better understanding of the criteria, because, you know, basically what you're telling us is that you're turning away 33% of workload. That means that there are certain crimes that have been committed that are not being fully investigated?
Madam Chair, I'd hesitate to put it that way.
Okay, how would you put it?
We don't know for sure what is out in the evidence lockers. Based on our interaction with our customers, we are sure that some evidence is not being submitted based on the guidelines. The exact amount of stuff that's not being submitted, we're not sure. Dave, do you want to?
Madam Chair, my discussions with the user agencies have a whole possible explanation for this, from the officers are no longer even picking up the evidence because they know they can't get it worked, to they pick it up and it stays in the evidence locker at the agencies, to they submit it and it stays in the evidence locker of the crime lab. There's a lot of the work that just isn't, we're not getting to because we don't have the staff. And the explanation for that really would have to come from our agencies that we service, because that evidence never gets to us. It stays in their locker. So what I've told you is some of the answers I've received from them is that there's a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen?
Well, do you have a written criteria in terms of how an officer is going to determine whether he picks up the material or whether he leaves it in a locker or whether he gets submitted to you?
That's the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes, we've shared with our customers our triage and prioritization guidelines. We'll make those available to you. I would think that some of what the agencies were telling me is that they can read those documents and realize that we're not going to get the certain kinds of crime, certain types of evidence. So they just either put it in their evidence locker and don't submit it, or they just don't pick it up at all.
Representative Hannah, and then Representative Wisnett. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's sort of disturbing. I mean, what do we have to do to analyze all the data and not have officers doing that? I mean, that's... if you're the victim, I'm sure you're discouraged. If you're the officer, I'm sure you're discouraged. So I thought we restored the lab, and I thought that was going to help the situation. But we're saying we need twice as many people to perform this, so officers aren't putting it in their locker, and the crime victims are being, you know, their issues are being, crimes are being looked into.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, let me first just make sure I don't want to overstate this. Crimes are being looked at, and in some cases, forensic evidence is much more critical than in other cases. It's possible to work some cases and bring them to successful prosecution without forensics evidence. I don't want to leave you with the impression today that crimes are simply not being looked at. At the same time, though, I will not leave you with the impression that conviction rate or that some crimes are not being handled properly because of the lack of forensics work. So I want to say too strongly either way. In fact, the crime lab was restored. We currently have 107 FTE. I believe we have nearly all those positions filled. I would like to talk just briefly about why our numbers have gone up a little bit.
Before you do that, I want to stay on this point for a moment, because if you're telling us that you're turning away 33% of possible workload, that still suggests that there are certain crimes that aren't being fully investigated.
Madam Chair, I think...
What am I missing?
I think as a general statement that is accurate. The impression I didn't want to leave to you is that because evidence isn't submitted to a crime lab, that crime may not necessarily be prosecuted. In some cases, the case can go forward without the forensics work. So I don't want to overstate. I want to be as accurate as I can. It certainly is impacting the criminal justice system. There are crimes that aren't being looked at that we would like to look at, but at the same time there are some that are being prosecuted successfully without the fact that they've been submitted to the crime lab.
I think what we need then, what would be helpful for me is to have an understanding, a listing, if you will, of what's in that 33% that you're not able to get to. What kind of evidence are we talking about? What kind of crimes, cases, where in the state, what does that 33% workload, what does that look like? Unpack that for us. Representative, what's that?
Madam Chair, and I think also we can look at the criteria that they're issuing the officers. But, I mean, this, like I said, this is disturbing again. I mean, if we have 300 officers out there and they're doing their work, but they're coming back and we need to provide them the capability to prosecute these crimes, I mean, we want to know that. I'll argue, and I'll stay up here and argue we need to do that. But I understand what you're saying, that some of those cases are being able to, you convict someone about the forensic investigation. But I think you need to give us that data and be honest with us, be upfront with us.
Yes.
So many crimes are going investigated because we can't investigate it, or these we don't need the forensic experts. So don't give us numbers that say 33%, because I mean, they got everyone's attention up here, that 33% of the crimes, that we have all the people on the road and everything. That's not what we want to hear, because we're concerned about public safety and we want to help you do your job. So I guess we'd look for the criteria, mm-hmm. and tell us what percentage of those 33% you think that you would like to have more people to provide more forensic investigation to help prosecute those people.
Okay. For example, can you tell us where does methamphetamine fit in your list of criteria? Methamphetamine related cases.
Okay. Dave, can you answer that specifically?
Methamphetamine.
Madam Chair, in regards to methamphetamine, I'm going to answer this question based upon clandestine laboratories, because they're mostly all methamphetamine laboratories. And right now, we do receive all of those, and we are pending 57 drug labs right now. And just to give you a perspective, that's probably the work for one person for 6 months. And that's increasing. There's an emphasis on these meth labs. Are some of those pending and still out in those agency lockers? I would hamper a guess that is no. The answer would be no to that. We are openly accepting those, but we are backlogging them. As to other casework, I'll do the best I can in talking with the agencies as to what's in their evidence lockers. We are interested in that as well. We actually considered hiring a temp to go around and try to dig that information out, but that we had to park that idea for economic reasons.
But there is currently a 6 month backlog of pending drug lab.
Yes.
Cases. Okay. That's helpful.
Madam Chair, in the governor's budget, they recognize the importance of the lab in the meth initiative and mm-hmm. include one position in this division
at the crime lab
for the meth initiative.
So what will that one position, how much relief are you going to get?
Madam Chair, before we go much further on this, so I'd like to get back to a point that Representative Wisnett made.
Please.
And again, do we need more forensic scientists? Yes, we do. I'm not trying to minimize what we need. I clearly want to state that. But I do think a little historical perspective will help you in understanding what we're trying to do right now and how we're trying to analyze just how big our problem is. As David has said, we really don't know what's in those evidence lockers. And we have, in fact, rehired many of the forensic scientist positions or filled the forensic scientist positions, almost all of them, that were laid off. But there's been some impact, some ripple to that. We had almost no luck recruiting forensic scientists until very recently. We've, since January, hired a large number of forensic scientists back. The committee needs to understand it takes about a year for that forensic scientist to be effective on their own. So, we're back up to 107, but we really don't have 107 full-time working scientists. We've got, I believe, about 13 of those have been recently hired, and they're in training, and that takes about a year. So that has brought our number up. So we have a little bit of a staffing problem right now as it relates to catching up to the budget layoffs that we had, the recruitment problem we had over the last 2 years since the layoffs. The forensics division hires people, unlike the rest of the department, from around the country. We recruit our forensic scientists from all over, and people were hesitant to move to Oregon and relocate and come to work for our department because of the layoffs, and we just didn't have much luck. And as we move away from 03, we're getting a better response now. We've been able to hire some really good quality people. But again, it's going to take about a year from their hire date to get them up and to be productive. So that fits into part of our problem right now.
Madam Chair,
helps. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Major, how about you asked for 121 FTEs. If you had 121 FTEs, would they be, 2% or 5% backlog? Or if you had the qualified people, is that what?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'll let Mr. Schmierbaugh answer that question.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, 120 is the staff we had in February of 2003 when we went through the layoffs in the scientific side. We also had some other staff in the program that's no longer. But 120, we're targeting to return to 120 to return to be able to do the work for the agencies that we service. Until we can get a good handle on what's out there being generated by all of the evidence that's out there, we really won't know if that meets the need or not. But we're guesstimating that that will meet the need based upon historical submission rates and the work that was being done in the criminal justice system.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think, again, if I'm going to argue, and with our chair's permission, we argue with the co-chairs, you need those 121. You've got to tell me you can bring that down to 5% or less or something. And, I understand your situation, but if we can't have some assurance that we're going to fill it and it's going to get down to a reasonable amount, which I assume would be less than 5% of backlog, we're really in trouble. And because as we received the list of all the bills that are going out for meth, and your work's not going to get less, it's going to get more. hopefully is there some technology or, you know, these guys on TV do it in a half an hour, they are.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I appreciate that. We do suffer from something called the CSI effect, and it's affecting our courtroom testimony. Certainly I can say today that reaching that staffing level is going to reduce our caseload dramatically. Again, though, I want to temper that with hiring those folks and getting them back up to speed. It takes time, and we would be well into the next biennium if we started today before we got everyone hired and trained and back up to speed and got operating to pre-layoff status. And that would impact, greatly reduce our turnaround time. You can look back at our chart and see that we were back down in about the 30-day range, which is about a 15-day improvement operating at that time. And we agree with you that our workload isn't going to get smaller. It isn't getting smaller.
More on this subject, members? Representative Hannah.
I just wonder if CSI has any positive impact from the standpoint, I mean, no kidding, that it sensationalizes some of the crime, forensics type jobs. I mean, has it helped any with your recruitment?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah. Yes, we get a lot of applications for people who want to come work for us based upon that show. Unfortunately, if it's just the show that brings them to us, they often don't meet the minimum qualification. But there is a large interest in being a forensic scientist right now.
Thank you. Please continue.
I believe, unless the committee has any more questions on forensics, I will move on to the next division.
You know, there is some pertinent information at the top of page 32 that I don't think I hear you say aloud in your testimony, that history has proven that the highest crime solvability rates occur within the first 3 to 7 days. With the passage of time goes witness recall, destruction of evidence, and the likelihood of solving even the most serious crime. Well, therein lies. Well, you follow what I'm leading to.
Yes, Madam Chair, I agree. It's long-standing, been understood for years that the quicker you get onto something and get that thing investigated and solved and brought to prosecution, the more success rate you have. I can think of working numbers of homicides in different parts of the state where if we go 24/7, as long as we can follow any kind of a lead, because we know the more time we put in early, the more likelihood we are going to have in solving that. And as time goes along, evidence is destroyed, people's memories change, and time is our enemy in law enforcement.
Representative Hansen.
Kind of on the same, in the same subject area, before we go too far. On the back, there's a backlog of DNA analyzation in terms of matching up from... I guess what I'd like to know is what's the status of like the historic DNA investigations that we every so often we see read something of some fairly important crime that's been solved with the DNA matches.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that's accurate. There are significant crimes being solved because of DNA evidence, and there is a backlog, and I'll let David talk about some of those numbers.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there are two backlogs that we need to refer to. One is the actual casework, where it comes in from a crime, and the second one is the convicted offender samples that are waiting to be analyzed and put into the database. Right now, we have federal grants to handle the convicted offender samples, and those are subcontracted out to a contract lab, and then there is a certain amount of time we spend putting them into the database. As far as casework is concerned, there is quite a large backlog there. There's about, I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I could get it for you. We feel that right now we're meeting the needs of the criminal justice community in that area, in that our prioritization is getting the analytical work done in enough time before trial. I'm sure they would like to have it sooner, but at least we are meeting the deadlines that they've asked for us to have it by. Now, could it be done faster and maybe save a lot of more effort on parts of other people in the criminal justice system? I would have to do some more research on that and get back to you.
The other information you could give me a guess or an estimate in terms of what causes the backlog. Is it lack of equipment, lack of lab space, or lack of personnel? And what would it take to get us caught up?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, are we referring to casework or the convicted offenders?
Convicted offenders.
The convicted offenders right now is, since they're subcontract out, it would be money to buy the subcontract samples. Right now, the federal government has supplied sufficient funds to catch up our backlog in that area. We're expecting those funds. We do not know what's going to happen to those funds for the future.
Okay. If you had everybody in the case files of everybody that's been convicted, if you had that data on file, then isn't there also a process of matching that goes on with evidence, DNA evidence that hasn't been on crimes that haven't been solved? I guess that's a backlog that I'm concerned with too.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, you have the right idea. We run the samples from crime scenes. And if we haven't got a suspect, we enter those into the database. As samples from convicted offenders are processed and entered into the database, we get these hits where we can identify who was responsible or at least involved in that crime. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it's around one for one crime solved, so to speak, for every 130, 140 samples we put into that database. So with all these unknown crimes, we put the samples in after we've analyzed them. Then we run these convicted offenders, and as we put them in, we're solving crimes.
I understand, Major Spirit, that you'd like to make a transition here to the State Medical Examiner's Division.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to do that. I would suggest, I think it's a good idea. I have Dr. Gunson here in the audience with me today.
All right. I understand the person has traveled from Portland to be with us. Well, let's do that.
That is, Madam Chair, page 45 of your document.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Karen Gunson. She is the State Medical Examiner, and I'd like to proceed with the testimony about her division. Dr. Gunson is the Division Director and, like I said earlier, the State Medical Examiner. The Medical Examiner's Division is within the Support Services Division and is supervised and directed by the State Medical Examiner. In Portland, in addition to Dr. Gunson, she has three other forensic pathologists that work for her, and she also has under contract two other doctors that work contracts in Lane County and in the Southern Oregon District, which includes Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas County. She's responsible for overseeing all death investigations in the state and also provides support to the county medical examiners located in each county. She has a fairly small staff and is located in the new crime lab medical examiner facility that's housed in Clackamas County. She was in what I would describe as probably the worst state facility that existed and now is in one of the better ones, and she's very pleased with the new facility. It's changed her ability to do a much better job for the state.
She has a couple medical transcriptionists that work for her that also provide support to the state and county medical examiners. The State Medical Examiner's Division investigates deaths that fall under the medical examiner's law, ORS 146, and you can see on page 45 there's a list of deaths that fall under this statute. It starts with violent or unusual deaths. This obviously includes suicides and homicides. Drug-related deaths continues on the next page with outside of hospital deaths. And these are deaths that occur outside medical facilities and that are not under medical care. There's deaths in police or government custody, deaths on the job, and identification of unknown remains is another category that is covered. Approximately 12% of all deaths in Oregon are investigated directly by the medical examiner, and 30% of all deaths in Oregon are reported to the medical examiner's system. The law requires that the medical examiner determine the cause and manner of death and officially certify the death by signing a death certificate. The purpose of the medical examiner's office is to supervise and direct death investigations and provide professional services to the criminal justice system. And that includes doing the autopsies. Dr. Gunson not only supervises the division, but I believe she does about 200 autopsies a year herself. They provide court testimony and review cases and consult with, for example, the county medical examiners. They also participate in teaching programs to increase the professionalism of forensic pathology around the state. Each county in Oregon has a physician, a county medical examiner appointed by Dr. Gunson, the state medical examiner. These physicians, though, are not necessarily forensic pathologists. They have a wide variety of medical specialties, but they're responsible for oversight of death investigations in their county, and they work closely with Dr. Gunson. And if you don't mind, Karin, could you briefly just kind of describe your interaction with the county doctors?
Dr. Gunson, if you could spell your last name, please, and also turn that microphone or if you want to make sure that we get you recorded. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Dr. Karin Gunson. My first name is K-A-R-E-N, and my last name is G-U-N-S-O-N.
Thank you.
Our interaction with county medical examiners is extremely close. As Major Spirit said, I, as the state medical examiner, appoint the county medical examiners in conjunction with the local medical exam or the local medical community and with approval of the local county commissioners. And they are in charge of the local death investigation. They report to my office via what we call rail lines, which is where they dictate over the telephone, or via email reports on every medical examiner death that occurs around the state. In conjunction with them, we decide what kind of investigation needs to be done on each death. For instance, if it's an elderly person who has known heart disease and dies suddenly at home, well, maybe a brief conversation with the local physician will allow us to wrap up that death investigation. However, if it's a suspicious or unusual death, it may be that we need to transport that person to the state medical examiner's office in Portland, do a complete autopsy with toxicology, and interact with law enforcement involving that investigation. So it ranges all the way from a few phone calls to extensive evaluation, both in the autopsy room and in the laboratory.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Doctor, is there a fee for that? The counties charge the person, and did you get any money back from that or anything?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnat, no, there is no fee for our services. The state put into law, the medical examiner's law, ORS 146, in 1966, and envisioned that the state would provide forensic pathology services for the entire state, but that the local communities would provide investigation, local investigation, that is scene investigation and communication with us. So there is no charge to the county for my autopsy or the toxicology that we do. However, they do have to cover the costs of the transportation of the body from
the county
to our facility. As a follow-up to that, 20 years ago when I first started, we would go to the counties and do autopsies in funeral homes. With the difficulties now that we have with bloodborne and airborne pathogens, we no longer feel comfortable doing that because we would submit not only ourselves to that danger but also people who are within that facility while we're doing the post. So we bring them to our facility where we can control those risks.
Okay, this follow-up measure. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, doctor, then, but do the counties charge people or for the service?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, no, they do not. This is a service to the people of Oregon.
Thank you. I don't think that's that way in every state, is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I am not aware of states that charge, though I only know about the medical examiner states, and there's many states in the United States where the death investigation is covered by a coroner who is an elected official and not a medical person.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'd also just clarify that we do charge for some autopsies provided. For example, the federal agencies. Dr. Gunson informed me earlier today that she'd done the number for the federal prison over at Sheridan. So there are situations, I believe one of the tribes has a contract. We do charge for some of those, but internal state investigations are it's a service provided by the state government. The service delivery for this division is, as I mentioned earlier, provided by four doctors, the state medical examiner, three other pathologists. There is a forensics administrator located at the Portland Medical Examiner's Office, and he deals with all the administrative issues related to that division and acts essentially as Dr. Gunson's right-hand man. There are the two medical transcriptionists that are, it's a real specialty. If you've ever listened to Dr. Gunson dictate an autopsy, there's all kinds of words that no one knows how to spell except for a medical transcriptionist, and they provide a critical service. Also in this next budget is one morgue tech position is funded. In the old medical examiner's office that we just moved out of, we had an arrangement with college students, stayed upstairs, would meet and check in the bodies at different hours and different things, and this position is going to help handle all those things in kind of the back room and be available to work with people that bring bodies into the facility. The medical examiner's office is on call 24/7. They take turns working through weekends so that they have someone on call. They do autopsies on the weekend. Again, timeliness is critical on these investigations. The cause of death is determined in 99% of the cases brought to the medical examiner's office. The other 1%, I'm not sure what those fall into.
The other 1% would fall in undetermined category, where despite the fact that we've done an autopsy and done complete toxicology, there are a few cases every year where we're not good enough or we don't have good enough science to figure out what happened to this particular person. Most commonly, it would be some type of cardiac arrhythmia, which causes death. And, of course, we can't see that when we do the autopsy. So there's a very few of those that we have. Never give up on them.
The medical examiner's division is not directly linked to any benchmark and doesn't have any formal performance measures. The customers of the division include, are listed on page 48, and they include some very obvious ones, families, which probably are right at the top of the list. Dr. Gunson doesn't just provide investigations of deaths that are violent, such as homicides, but in many cases she does death determinations that can bring peace to a family, and she can determine a lot of the questions that families have about the loss of their loved one. So families are number one.
another customer is the health division. When we know why people died, that information is critical to the greater health services within the state. Helps us set policy and set direction. You want to comment on that?
Okay. We do work in conjunction with the Health Services Division on a number of issues, including national violent death reporting systems, emerging infections programs, and we work closely with CDC in those areas as well. They have chosen Oregon for a number of these pilot studies because we do have a statewide medical examiner system that they can tap into and get information from.
Additional customers obviously include the district attorneys, defense attorneys, and the courts. They're a big part of the testimony and criminal prosecutions involving homicides and other types of crimes. Obviously, an accurate cause of death is critical as far as our justice system. Police agencies work very closely with the medical examiner's office. The police officers investigating the deaths are right in there with Dr. Gunson. Right now they have in the new facility an actual viewing area where they aren't in the same room anymore with the doctor when they do the examination, but they work right there, and Dr. Gunson works through the evidence with the police departments and helps them determine all kinds of things like bullet trajectory and those sorts of things. So they work very closely with police departments. They also work with Oregon Health Sciences University and the Department of DPSST in the area of training. That would conclude my phase one testimony for this division.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, congratulations on the presentation. It seems good, and even better is some of your performance for deliveries, 98%+ of the time within 24 hours, and figuring out the cause of death in over 99% of the cases. That seems to be great work. Transportation. It's mentioned in some of our information that we transport, it says remains, but I'm assuming bodies, transport bodies to the medical examiner's office. Where is that in terms of a line item on the budget? How do you pay for transportation? Or who gets paid for transportation?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, the transportation costs are covered by the county. And usually they utilize funeral homes which are located within the county, and the funeral home will charge the county. Now, there is a line item here where it says special payments to counties, and then there's a reimbursement. And we have, I believe, just under $85,000 in there. Part of the law says that we may reimburse counties if they do an autopsy at the local county level, because, of course, there would be hospital pathologists capable of doing natural disease deaths in those counties. And so we reimburse for that autopsy out of these funds, and we also reimburse the county a certain percentage of their transportation costs out of these special payments to counties.
Okay. Follow-up, Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. And lastly, again, our information indicates that the medical examiner's office continues to increase the use of due to continuing growth in Oregon's population and probably of aging to some degree. Will you provide us now or in phase two somewhat of a tracking? I mean, how many autopsies have we done historically? What's the increase? Where are we with that?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I do have that report from 2003. That's our latest numbers. It's from the Oregon Vital Statistics Report. It gives a breakdown of all deaths in the state plus all medical examiner cases, which ones are autopsies and the percentage thereof. I can make that available to you today. I'll just Xerox it for you. Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be great. And if it would give us maybe a little bit more historical data as well, so we kind of look at a trend line.
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I will be presenting that in phase two, hopefully,
great.
To your
okay.
satisfaction.
Very good. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanson.
Well, just a quick comment. First of all, thank you very much for the job you do for the state of Oregon. It must be an incredibly difficult job in some circumstances that I'm sure we don't envy you for, but we're very pleased that you're there to get get the job done for us. And congratulations on moving to the new facility. I mean, I was Multnomah County Commissioner before I came here, and I'm aware of how antiquated that facility was. And so it's wonderful that eventually we're out of it, although it's a beautiful building.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, thank you very much. It's just a great pleasure for me to be in a new facility. After being in the old one for 19 years, I have told people I can't believe that we stayed there that long because it's so wonderful in our new facility.
Well, for people that haven't seen it, it was like a 1920s era mortuary, and so part of the need to the crisis that we got to in turn was in terms of ventilation and mechanics on the building were so incredibly antiquated that probably we're just lucky that our staff didn't sue us for making them work in that situation. It's wonderful that it's one of the kind of milestone progresses that for the Portland area.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would also be glad to invite all of you up there to see that facility. Anytime you'd like a tour, the state can be really proud of that facility. It's a real, we kept the standards, minimum standards that are acceptable. It's a really great facility, and I'm sure Dr. Johnson would be proud to show it off to you. She no longer keeps bodies in the hallway. She no longer has a floor that soaks up the things that drip on it. It's just completely different, and we're real proud of it.
How much of your time, Doctor, is spent in the classroom teaching?
Madam Chair, I would I spend approximately 6 hours at the university a year, Oregon Health Sciences University, training both fourth-year students and first-year students in the area of forensic pathology and death certification. We have pathology residents from Oregon Health Sciences University who rotate with us on a monthly basis. We have those residents probably 3 or 4 times a year, so 4 months out of the year we would have a resident in our office training with us. We also provide deputy medical examiner training so we can train our own death investigators, which we have in every county. That's an 8-hour training. We're hoping to expand that to 40 hours for more scene investigation expertise in the outlying counties around the state. I would say that probably about 10%, maybe 15% of my time is spent in education, formal education. I hope I do that on the phone as well when I discuss things with both families and local law enforcement.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
Chair, for your service and for your presence here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Major Spirit, where would you like to go next?
Madam Chair, I'd like to go to page 32, the Information Management Division.
Okay. Page 32, members.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the Information Management Division consists of 4 sections. The division director is Mr. David Yandell, and he is out of state on business today. I've invited the director of one of the sections, Criminal Justice Information Services section, Mr. Terry O'Connell, here today to answer some specific questions. But this division is made up of 4 sections. The Enterprise Services section, Wireless Communication section, Criminal Justice Information Services section, and the Identification Services section. The first program that I'd like to just give you an overview on is the Enterprise Services section. And this is, for lack of a better term, these are our computer services folks. We have 10 people assigned to this program, one of which is a manager. And they are responsible for our statewide computer systems and programs at all of our facilities around the state. I think it's important to point out that they have a very diverse workload. There is hardly an aspect of our agency that isn't affected by this technology. It's used in forensics analysis. It's used in the patrol car. It's used in truck inspection. It's used by our clerical folks, whether they be in the ME's office or the other divisions you've heard about. It's a critical group of people that do critical work, and they're responsible for all the maintenance and design and procurement of our agency's computer infrastructure, which includes some of our databases, includes our internet service, and all our servers around the agency across the state. They're also responsible for our system security, email and other systems that require security in this, you know, in this day and age. The next section is the wireless communication section, and this is essentially our radio communication section. They're responsible for planning and integration and installation of a statewide law enforcement wireless communication network. And we have, as Superintendent mentioned earlier in his testimony, two communication centers, and then we have communication towers and a system throughout the rest of the state that allows our troopers to talk to each other and us to talk to some of our partners. This particular program is staffed by 9 employees. One of them is a manager. And they do everything from driving and operating snowcats in the winter to get up to a tower and fix it when it's down, to installing new equipment. They also work on programming our police radios and working with the communications center communication equipment. They provide radio communication systems for all of our divisions, including patrol, fish and wildlife, criminal, for our administrative staff. They also continue to provide services to CSEP in Eastern Oregon, which is a chemical stockpile, and for the State Fire Marshal's Office and OEM, which are now part of the new Office of Homeland Security. They have a lot of responsibility. The next section that I would like to overview...
Before you go on... Major, would you describe the wireless communication section and all that it is responsible for handling? Is this state-of-the-art equipment, state-of-the-art? Where do we fall?
Madam Chair, I appreciate that question. Our radio system, and when I speak of our radio system, it's closely tied to the rest of state government's radio system. We work closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation and Forestry and Corrections. Our radio system is in very sad shape. It is, in many cases, nearly 20 years old. The expected life expectancy of these programs is about 10 years. One of the first things I do when I became bureau commander was I asked my section leaders for the 5 things that keep them awake at night. And the section director, which is Don Fole, he listed 5 things for me. The first one was our radio system was going to fail within 2 years and there's nothing he can do about it. And I said, I don't need 2 through 5. That's enough. Our system is antiquated. There is some good news. I think beginning to formulate within state government, a committee has been put together with our partner agencies. We're beginning some discussions about combining our resources and developing a single state communication system instead of operating 4 separate systems like we have today.
This is tied to the capacity of the system. The design of the system is tied to Homeland Security and that new function and office. Can you speak about this section as it relates to Homeland Security and where are we deficient there? I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, how prepared are we to, in the case of some, you know, terrible, unforeseen incident. How prepared are we?
Madam Chair, again, I appreciate the question. I think as we saw in New York, when we have a major disaster, communications becomes a real problem. And in their particular case, they had tremendous problems. And we would have similar problems in some situations like that. We do have a redundancy built into our system. We do have the ability to back up one dispatch center with the other dispatch center. That's why we have two rather than just one. We're continuing to improve the program as we can with grant funds. We've been able to get some federal grant funding to improve some of our system. We're looking at more of that in the future. But there are gaps in our program, in our radio system. There are areas today where we don't have complete coverage or the kind of coverage we'd like to have, and we do have a lot of failure rates and things that the staff has to keep up with. They're out a lot, again, nights and weekends, trying to keep up with things when they go down, because the critical nature of our communication is when a police officer needs to talk to somebody, they need to be able to do that. And so I don't know if that answers your question or if it's even close.
Somewhat. Representative Hanna?
I just wonder, thank you, Madam Chair, in this area of communications, does each patrol officer also have a cell phone? I mean, is that one of the backups or redundancy?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, no, they don't. Many of our officers do have access to cell phones. It depends on somewhat where they're stationed and the effectiveness of the cell phone system. But they don't. They don't all have cell phones. They are used in some locations.
Follow up, please. I can't help but think of Bill Gates wrote a book some time back, The Road Ahead, and he talked about different countries that skipped entire generations of technology. And if this system is 20 years old, is there a system out there that jumps a whole segment of technology? I mean, is there a new technology out there that doesn't use the current tower-to-tower type communication that you currently have?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, there is new technology. The primary technology we're looking at as a state working group is microwave technology. We have some of that in place at this time. It still relies on towers and a network, a backbone network around the state. And that, I believe, at least initially, is what the state working group is looking at for state purposes, is a microwave system as opposed to the current analog system we have.
One more. This technology piece kind of, I mean, it seems like now we have XM and Sirius satellite radio receivers, and I'm not a technology buff completely, but I've always understood that the problem with satellite is not so much getting the signal but sending it from handheld positions. But is there any type of satellite communication where we're not relying on these towers everywhere?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't really feel qualified to answer that. I know we do use satellite phones, and there are issues with that. One of the things that is important to remember about Oregon is the geography. The rough terrain and those kinds of things make it difficult to communicate. And there are a lot of those technologies that you are speaking about that just aren't quite there yet as it relates to law enforcement. A lot of those things have been tried. They're the latest, coolest thing. We see them at all of our conferences, but they're just not quite there. The microwave system is there. It is, at this point, would be a good system. Thank you.
I think, members, that these are questions that we want to also pose to folks from Homeland Security when we have them present. What strikes me is that, you know, we are 21st century, living with 21st century challenges, terrorism, and all the rest of it. But the capacity that you're describing and defining to us is 20th century capacity, a radio system that's 20 years old and has maybe 2 years of life left. That's not an overstatement.
No, Madam Chairman, or Madam Chair, the system is old and antiquated, and it is it is antiquated technology. It's not overstating it. We in some cases are buying used parts. The federal government has initiatives to change FCC requirements. Some of the equipment that we rely on now, we will not be able to purchase any longer. They're being prohibited from manufacturing it because the federal government is trying to move this technology forward. Under the governor's executive order, the state interoperability executive committee has been put together, and that group is meeting with all our partners across the state trying to move this issue of interoperability forward on a statewide basis. We believe the state has a role to play in that and are participating in that with all our other partners. And so there is some movement here, but you are correct. We have long ways to go in this process.
That's definitely flagged, this issue.
Madam Chair, would you like someone to come in from the interoperability and sort of discuss the work group and discuss that issue in phase two?
I think that would be very, very helpful to our understanding. Representative Hansen?
I think in that same arena, if we could also get input on the department's vision of GIS, the local locating facilities? GIS?
GIS.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's $2.
Mm-hmm. When do I get my $2?
Tomorrow. We'll make arrangements. I'm just curious about one other thing. The name of this section is the Enterprise Services section. Enterprise, where did that come from?
Well, Madam Chair, the Enterprise Services section is our computer section. That's this is the wireless communications section. If you, it kind of slips by you there at the bottom of page 32.
Well, I understand that. I was just curious about the naming of the section. Calling it enterprise as opposed to computer section. Look, not a big deal. We don't have to belabor it.
Sorry about that.
Just curious. We have 3 minutes remaining. How would you like to end and give us a preview of where you'd like to start tomorrow?
Madam Chair, I have two more sections to go through in this division, and then I have two other divisions to go beyond this. I'd like to start on page 33 tomorrow with the Criminal Justice Information Services section, which is supervised by Mr. O'Connell. These are the two more complex sections within this division, and they have to do with a law enforcement data system, and then Identification Services section, which handles our handgun insta-check, our criminal history, our fingerprint files, and all those things. I'd like to start with those tomorrow.
Very
and
good.
Then continue on with the other two divisions. Should easily be able to finish tomorrow.
All right. That would be fine. Major Skirup, we thank you for your presentation this afternoon and for all the hard work that you put into preparing. Any closing comments? Questions?
Madam Chair, I would just recommend on this briefing on the interoperability, we finish the Homeland Defense before we have that briefing. Doug.
Very good. Well, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 5057, the Oregon Department of State Police. And we're adjourned.